Welcome to Justice Studio Sessions. I am Marianne Moore, foundress of Justice Studio. During these sessions, we will be exploring the social justice themes that have emerged through Justice Studio's work, showcase grassroots activism, and deep dive into ethical and equitable research and consultancy methods. Stay tuned to learn more about the complexities of social justice and how you can turn your passion into action. Hello, dear listeners. In this penultimate episode of Series 1, we will be talking about international safeguarding scandals. In 2019, Justice Studio undertook work for the UK's then Department for International Development as a subcontractor for the company DAI. The project was to map all of the existing systems and platforms that were being used to check the identity, security clearance, and conduct record of people in the aid sector. The mapping and our recommendations were to inform the exploration of setting up a passport system to prevent perpetrators of sexual exploitation and abuse moving around the sector undetected. This project was a response to a scandal that broke in the humanitarian sector in 2018, where it was discovered that senior Oxfam staff had paid local young women for sex whilst working in the response to the Haiti earthquake. As it turned out, this was not an isolated incident. The scandal highlighted the problem of the lack of regulation in the aid sector and the fact that perpetrators of the sexual abuse were able to move around the sector undetected. In this episode, I'll be talking about three scandals that shook the international aid community. First, I'll discuss the UN DynCorp trafficking case in Bosnia in the early 2000s. Then the UNHCR peacekeepers scandal in Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone around the same time. And finally, I'll explain what happened in the Oxfam Haiti scandal, which broke in 2018, in more detail. Please be advised that we will be covering a lot of distressing topics in this episode, and we will reference various types of abuse that might be difficult or triggering for people to hear. So please take good care of yourself as you listen, and do not listen if you're concerned it may impact you negatively. Almost 20 years before the Oxfam Haiti scandal broke in 2018, another scandal had shown how those working for aid agencies could be active and powerful agents of abuse. The war in Bosnia began in 1992 as the Soviet Union collapsed and Bosnia and Herzegovina declared independence from Yugoslavia. In April, Serb forces shelled Sarajevo, targeting Muslims and Croats, and then went on to carry out looting, burning, and massacring of the Bosniak-populated regions around the country. Concentration camps detaining Muslims and Croats were set up in four regions, and between 1992 to 1995, thousands of women and girls suffered rape and other forms of sexual violence. In August 1995, NATO launched airstrikes against the Serbs and they finally retreated. This resulted in the signing of the Dayton Peace Agreement in December 1995, ending the war, and the region was renamed Bosnia-Herzegovina. As part of the Dayton Agreement, the UN Security Council mandated the creation of a mission in Bosnia and Herzegovina to rebuild the country. It was to provide an International Police Task Force, IPTF, and a UN Civilian Affairs Office. The IPTF was made responsible for monitoring and advising local Bosnian police and comprised of police officers from nearly 50 UN member states. The American contingent of this force was comprised of those under the employ of a private firm. In 1995, the contract was won by the Virginia-based company DynCorp. They were a large private military and security organization. The governance of these organisations was complex. Although DynCorp was not technically part of the IPTF, they did provide the staff and handled payroll and administrative and logistical issues. Employees of DynCorp reported to the IPTF chain of command, who in turn reported to the UN representative to the Secretary General, or the SRSG, who was an American diplomat. DynCorp contractors held UN command positions as well, so the organisations were kind of intricately connected. And because of their UN status, DynCorp contractors were immune from the law. They were not held to US law, nor to military regulations, nor to the laws of Bosnia. Although technically their immunity could be waived by the UN Secretary General, there was and is little precedent for waiving immunity because there are doubts about the kind of treatment that they may receive, and it's deemed to prejudice the interests of the UN. So it was into this context, in April 1999, a police officer from Nebraska named Catherine was contracted to work for DynCorp in Bosnia as a police monitor. She began working for the Human Rights Department. And from the outset, Catherine was presented with a disturbing utterance from one of her male colleagues that he knew where to get really nice 12 to 15 year old girls. Initially unsure of how to take this comment, it soon began to make a horrific sense. In late 1999, the partially clothed body of a young woman was found floating down a river in Bosnia. She was wearing a short, tight skirt and revealing top. Her bone structure revealed that she was of Ukrainian heritage. Indeed, trafficking had begun to appear in the country as soon as the influx of international peacekeepers, international police, and civilian contractors poured in. Women and girls trafficked from Moldova, Romania, and Ukraine were held in debt bondage, forced to provide sexual services to clients, falsely imprisoned, and beaten when they did not comply with the demands of brothel owners who had purchased them and deprived them of their passports. Catherine was introduced to the situation when she was referred a girl found before dawn wandering deliriously through the banks of the River Bosnia. Talking to this girl led Catherine to raid the Florida nightclub, where she found the passports of several girls from Moldova, Romania, and Ukraine, and locked in a stuffy attic-like room, seven wide-eyed young women. She described how the girls were wearing sweatpants and t-shirts that were either too large or too small, their faces coated with smeared, slept-in makeup. The only furnishings in the room were two bare, stained mattresses on the floor, which the seven of them had been sharing. Littered about were a few plastic grocery bags full of miniskirts and glittery tank tops, their work clothes, and there was also a trash can with a wrinkled condom dangling over the edge. Initially, they were too scared to talk. One said, "We don't want to end up floating." However, gradually, they provided descriptions of their clients, who turned out to be Catherine's colleagues, IPTF officers, local police, and military men. Although she forwarded her findings up the chain of command all the way to the SRSG, the case was swept under the rug. Apart from the immunity issue, a boys' club permissive culture and a desire to protect their own organisational reputation was palpable. It is notable that DynCorp were contracted to receive bonuses from the US government for mission time that saw no incidents. So Catherine continued to receive reports of trafficking and supported girls who came to her, often with serious health problems and drug addictions, because their captives knew that women kept in an addicted stupor would be more compliant. And she constantly encountered issues with them being too scared to talk because of the harm that they were in, and because the young women didn't know who they could trust. Indeed, some policemen came to bars at night, and others came as their rescuers by day. Yet, despite the constraints, the evidence was mounting that DynCorp staff, IPTF station monitors and commanders, diplomats and local police officers were frequenting the brothels, raping girls, paying for sex with women, buying girls and women, and taking bribes. It was an open secret that some IPTF monitors were cohabiting with, quote, very, very, very young women who were clearly not from Bosnia. One monitor even complained to Catherine that his girlfriend, in quotes, who he had bought from the owner of one of the clubs, had run away and he was sad about it. At the same time as Catherine was uncovering all of this, another employee of DynCorp in a different canton called Ben had reported to his superiors that his direct supervisors and fellow employees were purchasing weapons and trafficking girls aged 12 to 15 from the Serbian mafia. Ben reported that company employees were boasting about, quote, buying and selling women for their own personal enjoyment, and about the various ages and talents of the individual slaves they had purchased. He reported that, quote, a lot of people said you can buy a woman and how good it is to have a sex slave at home. In a later court case, he described how someone had said to him, quote, he'll get me one for you. You can have one for 100 marks a night, or buy them for 2,000 or 3,000 marks. They can be yours and they can be your hose, end quote. According to Ben, the Dyncorp men would forge passports for the girls, rape them, and as a pastime, buy and sell them to each other. The Dyncorp site supervisor, his boss, had even videotaped himself raping 2 girls who were clearly saying no and resisting. He had distributed the tape to men in the hangar. He later admitted to this rape. When Ben's reports fell on deaf ears as well, he went to the Army Criminal Investigation Division, the CID, who conducted an investigation and substantiated his allegations. Yet, the problem was that the culprits were immune from the law. Although the CID could have explored waiving the immunity of these contractors, they didn't. And in fact, the CID turned the case over to Dyncorp, which quietly sent the men back to the States with no prosecution or blemish on any record. Then Dyncorp fired Ben. The discharge letter stated that he had, quote, brought discredit to the company and the US Army, end quote. A third whistleblower in Bosnia, David, found evidence of organised crime members within the ranks of the IPTF and human rights investigators being threatened to halt further investigations. He found that 2 Romanian IPTF officers had allegedly recruited Romanian women, purchased false papers for them, and sold them into Bosnian brothels. Yet there had been a real reluctance on the part of the United Nations leadership to investigate the cases. He reported in 2002 to a subcommittee of the US Congress that there was, quote, an astonishing cover-up attempt. It seemed to extend to the highest levels of the UN headquarters. The Department of State purposefully distances itself from US IPTF members by hiring Dyncorp as the middleman and makes no attempt to know anything about the activities of its IPTF officers who are serving as representatives and ambassadors of the United States, end quote. Catherine herself continued to experience the same blocks as she tried to escalate her findings. In frustration, at one point she sent an email to 50 mission personnel about the dire situation of the trafficked young women in Bosnia in order to try and inspire empathy and reflection among her colleagues. In the email, she explained how a woman had been forced to dance naked on a table in a bar, and for kicks, the bar owner smashed a light bulb above her head and forced her to hold hot electrical wires while she danced. When this began to bore him, he yanked her by the hair and raped her. Inspiring empathy with the email didn't work. Indeed, far from listening, following this email, Catherine was banished to another desk in Bosnia. Then in April 2001, she was dismissed on the bogus claim that she had falsified timesheets. Nevertheless, Human Rights Watch were looking into it as well. In March 1999, and again in March 2001, Human Rights Watch researchers travelled to Bosnia to investigate trafficking. They uncovered brothels scattered throughout both entities of Bosnia and Herzegovina, filled with young women from Ukraine, Moldova, and Romania. Women in the brothels reported that they had been sold from brothel owner to brothel owner, placed in debt bondage, threatened, and beaten. One woman from Ukraine told them, quote, I came to work in a bar. I knew nothing when they took me to Serbia. I was sold there 4 times to different men. They brought me to a bar and told me I had to work as a prostitute. And so I worked, but they never paid me. And every time I refused to work, they beat me, end quote. Later court documents and United Nations internal records obtained by Human Rights Watch indicated extensive police complicity and corruption, which made trafficking in Bosnia possible and highly profitable. In some towns, the local police actually held the women's passport in the police station, making escape virtually impossible. Local police frequently patronised the brothels, sending a message to the women that it would be futile to go to the police. The police were the owners' friends. In one town, the police even owned part of a nightclub as members of their local soccer club. There was also clear complicity and involvement in trafficking by US civilian contractors employed to provide services for the Stabilization Force and NATO. The contractors faced numerous allegations of buying women, transporting trafficked women, and violence against trafficking victims. Human Rights Watch reported that IPTF had engaged in illegal activities, either as customers of trafficked women or as outright purchasers of trafficked women and their passports. Yet, rather than request that UN headquarters waive the immunity from criminal prosecution enjoyed by IPTF monitors in Bosnia and Herzegovina, the mission had merely repatriated police monitors accused of involvement in trafficking. 18 monitors had returned home, either voluntarily or through disciplinary repatriation, for sexual misconduct, but none had faced criminal investigation or prosecution. As of October 2002, the United Nations mission in Bosnia and Herzegovina said that they suspected at least 25% of the women and girls in nightclubs and bars across Bosnia had been trafficked. But Catherine said this number was a vast underestimate. Further, it was estimated that international personnel accounted for 30 to 40% of the clientele and approximately 70% of the revenue from trafficking in Bosnia. In the end, the entities whose personnel were implicated included the UN and NATO, as well as private corporations like DynCorp and others. Nevertheless, DynCorp kept its contract with the US government to provide police to Bosnia. Catherine would go on to win her case against unfair dismissal by DynCorp, and they began to appeal but eventually dropped it. The men who testified against her, who during the court case were ruled to be not credible and of having acted in discriminatory, malicious ways, all kept their high-level positions and several were promoted to the high-level management positions within DynCorp. DynCorp moved its legal jurisdiction to Dubai in the United Emirates, making it virtually impossible for new lawsuits to be tried expeditiously. And 3 days after dropping their appeal against Catherine, DynCorp issued a press release stating that the US State Department had awarded them a $22 million contract to police Iraq. In Iraq, its contract was renewed in 2007 for another 2 years, despite a tarnished record there. In Iraq, it appeared that DynCorp could not properly account for most of the original $1.2 billion it received from the US State Department. There were also allegations of killings, drug and weapon smuggling, some rapes, caught on videotape, and major accounting blunders. In 2008, three former military contractors from Halliburton, Kellogg's, Brown and Root, KBR, and a subcontractor of DynCorp, testified to abuse of local Iraqis, such as denying Iraqi employees clean water, graft and gouging, which is police corruption, billing the government for projects that were never completed or never even begun, and double billing for laptop computers, food and vehicles. A black market of procurement of weapons had emerged, and there was contractor involvement in a prostitution ring. According to one testimony by a technology consultant employed as a subcontractor for DynCorp in Iraq, he said, quote, "A co-worker was killed when he was travelling in an insecure car and shot performing a high-risk mission. I believe that my co-worker could have survived if he had been riding in an armoured car. At the time, the armoured car that he would otherwise have been riding in was being used by a manager to transport prostitutes from Kuwait to Baghdad. Although the activities had been going on for some time, nothing was done to stop it. Eventually, the ringleader was pulled from his managerial position, but he wasn't fired. Rather, he was transferred to another post on a contract in Haiti." End quote. Nevertheless, despite all of this, DynCorp then went on to get a contract in Afghanistan. In July 2009, Catherine got a call from a man who told her about how his friend, employed by DynCorp in Afghanistan, was now in protective custody in Kabul after blowing the whistle on what he termed, quote, "immoral behaviour by the top brass," end quote. The caller alleged abuse of a local Afghani boy, telling her that DynCorp was whitewashing the story by saying a boy was asked to perform a ritual dance for a DynCorp party, but it was way more than that, he insisted, and there's a videotape. He also said that his friend was, quote, scared to death of DynCorp, end quote. Later that month, the Washington Post broke the story, stating DynCorp fired 4 senior managers in Afghanistan over the party and other incidents, according to employees who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they feared retaliation. Despite all this, as Catherine says, quote, for DynCorp, government contracts were practically on auto-renew. Taxpayer money kept pouring in as more and more contractors were shipped out around the world. To Haiti, Kosovo, Liberia, Serbia, and East Timor. In 2020, DynCorp was bought by the defence support services conglomerate Amentum. On April the 21st, 2021, the DynCorp name was discontinued. Amentum is the second largest government services contractor in the US government's contracting market. Around the same time as the story in Bosnia broke, a story in West Africa also emerged. In West Africa, civil wars in Liberia and Sierra Leone during the 1990s had left populations devastated and spilled into the neighbouring country of Guinea. The first Liberian civil war began in December 1989 when the National Patriotic Front of Liberia, the NPFL, led by Charles Taylor, invaded from the Ivory Coast to overthrow the government. They gained control over most of the country within a year, but then when the Independent National Patriotic Front of Libya, the INPFL, splintered off from the NPFL, the insurrection turned to infighting. Peace negotiations and foreign involvement led to a ceasefire in 1995, but fighting continued until August 1996. After that, Charles Taylor was elected president in 1997, but the civil war killed around 200,000 people and led to the involvement of the United Nations. Meanwhile, in Sierra Leone, civil war broke out from March 1991 when the Sierra Leonean Revolutionary United Front, the RUF, with support from Charles Taylor's NPFL, attempted to overthrow the government. The resulting war lasted almost 11 years. A second civil war broke out in Liberia in 1999 when an anti-Taylor rebel group called the Liberians United for Reconciliation and Democracy, LURD, invaded the north. Then, in early 2003, a second anti-Taylor rebel group invaded southern Liberia. Taylor resigned in August 2003. This resulted in the Accra Comprehensive Peace Agreement, and the United Nations mission in Liberia was deployed in the country. The wars in Sierra Leone and Liberia had spread to Guinea. Sierra Leone's RUF and Liberian rebels launched attacks into Guinea, accusing them of supporting and hosting rebels. Refugees, Guineans, and humanitarian aid workers at Guinea's border became targets and victims of the fighting. The escalating violence at the border area ultimately prompted the UNHCR and the Guinean government to decide in February 2001 to relocate the refugee camps to the interior of the country. By the end of May 2001, UNHCR had relocated some 57,000 refugees. The decade-long civil wars had seen appalling human rights abuses. Tens of thousands of Sierra Leoneans and Liberians were killed, thousands were maimed, and millions displaced. Violations of human rights and international humanitarian law included summary execution, systematic rape and enslavement of women, the use of civilians as human shields, the abduction and use of children as soldiers, and the particularly horrific practice of limb amputation. By 2001, there were UN peacekeeping forces across these three countries. The protections afforded to military peacekeepers, who are contributed by national governments, and who make up the overwhelming majority of UN peacekeepers, are broad. According to the Memorandum of Understanding agreed between a troop-contributing country and the UN, only the troop-contributing country can prosecute its military member for crimes committed on mission. These peacekeepers are thus never subject to the host state's jurisdiction, even for serious crimes. And the extent to which the troop-contributing country takes seriously their obligations to hold their soldiers accountable varies. While some might be active about investigating, others effectively turn a blind eye. In this context, in 2001, an assessment was carried out by UNHCR and Save the Children on the effects of sexual violence in the conflict on children in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. However, this revealed something not anticipated. When the researchers had conducted their study, they were shocked and concerned to discover that children reported sexual abuse not just as a result of the wars, but from aid workers who were meant to be supporting and protecting them. What emerged were 67 allegations of sexual exploitation and abuse against refugee children by personnel from 40 aid agencies and 9 peacekeeping battalions. The UNHCR found that a relatively prosperous elite of male UN staff, peacekeepers and NGO workers were exploiting children, using their power and influence by giving aid and money in exchange for sexual favours from children. The authors reported that the findings of the assessment indicate that sexual violence and exploitation of children appears to be extensive in the communities visited and involves actors at all levels, including those who are engaged to protect the very children they are exploiting. UN staff, security forces, staff of international and national NGOs, government officials, and community leaders. The report found that those who exploited children were often men in positions of relative power and influence, who either controlled access to goods and services or who had wealth and income. This power and influence was then used in exchange for sexual favours from children. The report indicated that the perpetrators often used the very humanitarian aid and services intended to benefit the refugee population as a tool of exploitation. As one child in Liberia said, quote, "It's difficult to escape the trap of these NGO people. They use the food as bait to get you to have sex with them," end quote. Allegations by children were confirmed by adults. One refugee woman in Guinea said, quote, "In this community, no one can access CSB, a soya nutrient, without having sex first. They say, quote, a kilo for sex," end quote. A man from Sierra Leone said, quote, "If you do not have a wife or a sister or a daughter to offer the NGO workers, it's hard to have access to aid," end quote. It was reported that even though agency workers may pay more than other exploiters, this might still amount to very little. They said, for example, that a Liberian refugee girl may get the equivalent of 10 US cents in exchange for sex, for which she would only be able to buy a couple of pieces of fruit or a handful of peanuts. More often than not, payment would be in kind, such as a few biscuits, a plastic sheet, or a bar of soap. It was claimed that even some very young children were asked to pose naked in exchange for biscuits, cake powder, or other food items. One girl told the investigation, quote, "When Ma asked me to go to the stream to wash plates, the peacekeeper asked me to take my clothes off so that he could take a picture. When I asked him to give me money, he told me, 'No money for children, only biscuit.'" End quote. Children and adults spoke of teenage girls being asked to strip naked, bathe and pose in certain positions, while the peacekeepers took pictures, watched and laughed. Some were alleged to have raped the girls without using condoms. Refugees felt unable to challenge the behaviour of agency staff, firstly because of their dependence on the goods and services for their survival, and secondly because of the power held by these staff. Those refugees who had tried to send written complaints through other staff complained that the information had been held back. Children complained that they are harassed or labelled or denied services when they tried to complain. Even if these reports had been taken seriously, the people were in a bind because they relied on the men for their subsistence. As a child mother in Guinea reported, complaining would be counterproductive. quote, "If I tell you the name of the NGO worker I have to have sex with, he will get fired. And then how will I feed my child and myself?" End quote. There was an additional significant group of young women who had had children as a result of being raped and abused. When the researchers spoke to them, they said, quote, "In most meetings, the girl mothers displayed visible signs of broken spirits. They were the only group that at times were not even able to give the assessment team recommendations. They were resigned to their situations to a degree that they saw no way through. Most of them had become mothers between the ages of 13 and 16. Even though those girls were now 19, they already had 3 to 4 children and had first become pregnant when they were 13 or 14 years old. Regardless of who the father was, they took no responsibility for the child and the mother." End quote. One girl mother in Sierra Leone said, quote, "They want you when you are young and single, but once you get pregnant and with a child, they reject you." End quote. Another girl mother from Guinea said, quote, "An NGO worker made me pregnant, but now he left me and is loving to another young girl." End quote. Sick. The horrifying contents of this report was widely reported in the global media in February 2002. As a result of the report, in March 2002, the Interagency Standing Committee, comprised of a number of UN agencies and the World Bank, mandated to give recommendations that specifically aim to eliminate sexual exploitation and abuse by humanitarian personnel. The task force reported on the 13th of June 2022, and they set out a plan of action which focused on a number of areas and practical steps that the international community should take. Their recommendations included clearly defining the principles and standards of behaviour that they expect of staff, which in turn included being explicit that sexual activity with children is prohibited, regardless of the age of majority or the age of consent locally, and that mistaken belief in the age of the child is not a defence. They said that the exchange of money, employment, goods or services for sex, including sexual favours or other forms of humiliating, degrading or exploitative behaviour, is prohibited. And this includes exchange of assistance that is due to beneficiaries. And they also set out that sexual relationships between humanitarian workers and beneficiaries are strongly discouraged since they are based on inherently unequal power dynamics. It mentioned that such relationships undermine the credibility and integrity of humanitarian aid work. The task force emphasised that accountability needs to be addressed at individual agency level and collectively, and that managers must be tasked with promoting a culture of protection in which exploitation and abuse is not tolerated, and reports of possible violations are treated seriously and confidentially. Sadly, not long later, in 2004, reporting by journalist Kate Holt documented sexual exploitation and abuse by both UN peacekeepers and UN civilian personnel in the UN mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Although, as a result, in response, the UN carried out a comprehensive review, known as the ZAID Report, it did not make concrete or clear recommendations regarding criminal immunity for peacekeepers. It asked the Secretary General to look into the matter further. Then in 2008, a report called No One to Turn To, Underreporting of Child Sexual Exploitation and Abuse by Aid Workers and Peacekeepers in Haiti, Côte d'Ivoire and South Sudan by Save the Children, indicated that significant levels of abuse of boys and girls continued in emergencies, with much of it going unreported. The report pointed out that any measures to tackle sexual exploitation and abuse are dependent on the willingness and the ability of victims and survivors and their carers to report the abuse experienced. Yet, children and their families were not speaking out because of stigma, fear, powerlessness, and a perception that nothing happens when abuses are reported. The study found 3 gaps. Victim-survivor communities, especially children and young people, were not being supported and encouraged to speak out about the abuse against them. 2, there was weak leadership on the issue, and in many parts of the international system, leading to poor implementation of effective practice. And three, there was an acute lack of investment in tackling the underlying causes of child sexual exploitation and abuse in communities. Abuse not just by those working on behalf of the international community, but by a whole range of local actors. These findings were backed up by another study of 2007 to 2008. To complain or to not complain, still the question, which came from consultations with humanitarian aid beneficiaries on their perceptions of efforts to prevent and respond to sexual exploitation and abuse in Kenya, Namibia, and Thailand. The vast majority of the 295 consulted in this 2007 to 2008 study said that they would not complain about the misconduct because they had few channels to complain, there was a lack of confidentiality, and they did not want to make a problem for fellow refugees. In 2016, the UN Security Council Resolution 2272 empowered the Secretary General to repatriate military and formed police units, quote, when there is a credible evidence of widespread or systematic sexual exploitation and abuse by that unit, end quote. However, this does not mean that the Secretary General waives immunity in these cases, either for civilian or military peacekeepers. Indeed, even should the Secretary General exercise his authority to repatriate units, the peacekeepers concerned are still subject only to their home country's authority, not to the host country. And so to our final case. On Tuesday, the 12th of January, 2010, at 16:53 in the afternoon, an earthquake with a magnitude of 7.0 struck Haiti. Rescue efforts began in the immediate aftermath of the earthquake, which evolved into recovery efforts. However, a few months into the recovery effort, aid agencies were criticised as being dysfunctional and inexperienced. One commentator said, quote, the people of Haiti are still living in a state of emergency with a humanitarian response that appears paralysed. It was reported that gang leaders and landowners were intimidating the displaced and that sexual, domestic and gang violence in and around the camps was rising. They claimed that rape of Haitian women and girls who had been living in the camps since the January earthquake was increasing, in part because the United Nations weren't doing enough to protect them. In January 2011, 1 year after the quake, Oxfam published a report on the status of the recovery, saying that relief and recovery were at a standstill due to government inaction and indecision on the part of the donor countries. The report stated, quote, only 5% of the rubble has been cleared and only 15% of the required basic and temporary houses have been built, end quote. But what Oxfam failed to mention was what was happening inside the organisation, and in particular, what its country director in Haiti had been up to. This wasn't uncovered until 7 years later, when, in February 2018, Sean O'Neill, writing in the Times newspaper, revealed that Oxfam Great Britain staff, including the country director, had been paying local young women for sex in Haiti whilst working on the humanitarian response to the earthquake. It appeared that as a result of an internal investigation, three Oxfam staff, including the country director, were allowed to resign without further penalty, and four were dismissed for gross misconduct. Oxfam failed to report the matter to the Charity Commission of the UK, or the Department for International Development, or any other authority in clear terms, for fear of reputational damage. In doing so, the organisation exacerbated the risk of allowing the perpetrators to be re-employed within the sector and prevented the issue from being aired and tackled effectively. It also seemed that concerns about two of the individuals who would later come under investigation in 2011 were already known about by senior staff in Haiti in 2010. The sparks that ignited the initial Oxfam investigation had come on the 12th of July 2011. A whistleblower alleged to Oxfam leadership in Britain that various members of staff in the Haiti project had breached the Oxfam Code of Conduct. Quote, the alleged breaches related to sexual exploitation, use of prostitutes in Oxfam Great Britain guest houses, and sexual harassment of staff, fraud, negligence, and nepotism. End quote. Following the whistleblower's allegations, Oxfam Great Britain commenced an internal investigation on the 23rd of July. The investigation found that the country director had used, quote, prostitutes, end quote, in his GB residence. He admitted this and was allowed, quote, a phased and dignified exit, end quote, a leniency not given to less senior members of staff. During the investigation, it transpired that three of the suspects physically threatened and intimidated one of the witnesses who had been referred to in the report. This incident led to further charges of bullying and intimidation against these three members of staff. As a result of this Oxfam internal investigation, disciplinary proceedings were begun on 10 members of staff, from which at least four members of staff were dismissed and two resigned, including the country director. The final internal investigation report concluded that, quote, none of the initial allegations concerning fraud, nepotism, or use of underage prostitutes was substantiated during the investigation, although it cannot be ruled out that any of the prostitutes were underaged, end quote. However, on the 12th of February 2018, the UK's Charity Commission opened an inquiry into the charity and this internal investigation, and they found that Oxfam did not fully investigate whether or not the women were underage. In one part of the investigation, it was uncovered that there were two emails sent to an Oxfam GB senior executive dated the 18th of July 2011 and the 20th of August 2011, both said to be from a 13-year-old girl about herself and a 12-year-old girl, which made different and further allegations of physical and sexual abuse. However, the internal inquiry was informed that it was suspected by Oxfam that these were not genuine, and as a result, the inquiry did nothing to investigate them further, nor did it report the allegations to the Charity Commission or any appropriate law enforcement agencies. Oxfam said later in 2018, quote, today, such a serious allegation would be dealt with very differently, end quote. But the subsequent review of the investigation by the Charity Commission seemed to support this ultimate view that the emails were fake, because IPN addresses used in the emails indicated that they were transmitted via a proxy server based in the United States, which masked the identity and location of the sender and seemed to them an implausible action for a non-English-speaking 13-year-old girl. However, it's all very strange. When the allegations about Oxfam GB staff appeared in the media in February 2018, various additional allegations surfaced specifically about the past conduct of Oxfam's country director in Haiti. Media reports found that the country director had been sent home from his job in Liberia when he was working there in 2004, after complaints prompted an investigation into sex parties with young local women. The then whistleblower Malik told IRIN how her initial complaints had pushed him out of a job as Liberia's country director of the UK charity Merlin, which is a medical group which is now merged with Save the Children. Malik explained that she had been assigned to stay in one of two guest houses rented by Merlin, and one weekday morning she had found one of her housemates in the guest house joking with and fondling a young Liberian woman in the kitchen. The woman, she said, appeared very young. Immediately she took her colleague aside and explained she wasn't going to tolerate sex work in the house, and she reported it. Within a fortnight, Merlin had sent a senior two-person team to Monrovia to investigate. They concluded that the management team, quote, four middle-aged men, unquote, were all engaged in paying for sex. They had been using Merlin cars to ferry women to and from the NGO's two guest houses for paid sex and parties involving sex workers. The Merlin investigator recalled that, quote, it was impossible to say if some of the women were underage, end quote. The country director and the rest of the Liberia management team had been, quote, shameless, unquote, Malik told IRIN. Quote, they acted like it was the most normal thing in the world, end quote. In the wake of the Civil War, quote, the behaviour at the time in Monrovia was insane, unquote, she recalled. quote, "I think Merlin were a bit worse, but plenty of UN types were doing the same. Lots of sleazy bars and girls on the beach," end quote. She recalled her deeper concern at the time being about this apparent culture of complacency that allowed men, ostensibly working for charitable causes, to conduct this behaviour more or less in the open. In the sector, it's, quote, "a system failure," end quote, and a lack of responsibility to protect children and vulnerable women, she said. The transactional sex was widely known by colleagues, male and female, who seemed to have accepted it as normal. Following his dismissal from the Liberia Project and Merlin, the country director was then employed by Oxfam from 2006 in Chad, again as a country director, and then for a short time in 2010 in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC. Although it was discovered that Oxfam Great Britain did not appear to know about the country director's previous dismissal from employment in Liberia, they did know about rumours from Chad. These were rumours circulating in 2007 amongst Oxfam staff about, quote, prostitutes and, quote, inappropriate relationships. Concerns about breaches of Oxfam's code of conduct by staff connected with an overnight stay in Oxfam's premises in Chad were also raised with local Chad management in 2007. They were discussed but not escalated past country level, and in the end, apparently could not be substantiated. But during the 2011 internal Oxfam Haiti investigation, one of the witnesses raised the possibility of the use of prostitutes by staff in the past in Chad, but these leads were not followed up. It appeared that there had been some overlaps between three of the individuals accused in Haiti when they had been working together in Chad. As well as this backlog of abuse by the Haiti country director in Liberia and in Chad, the Charity Commission investigation also uncovered subsequent allegations arising about the alleged sexual misconduct of staff of Oxfam in the Philippines in 2013. And on top of this, the outrage provoked by Oxfam's behaviour was magnified by further allegations in the media of similar cases in other international and multilateral aid organisations. The whole thing reflected a culture of abuse and impunity in the aid sector. In response, in October 2018, DFID hosted an international summit bringing together organisations from across the sector to commit to root and branch change. Key initiatives were announced, one of which was DFID's commitment to the concept of the ID, or the Aid Worker Passport System, which had been put forward by a group of UK INGOs convened by Save the Children. DFID agreed to provide support to help test the concept and drive the initiative forward, with an aim to testing it in 2020. Justice Studios' work was part of that process. Following a UK general election, though, on the 2nd of September 2020, the Department for International Development, DFID, was merged with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office to form the new Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, the EFCDO. On the 30th of January 2024, the EFCDO published their progress report on safeguarding against sexual exploitation and abuse and harassment in the aid sector, looking back on progress over the last 5 years since the Oxfam Haiti scandal. This report is linked in the show notes, along with all the other references I've used in this episode. I wish I could say that things have dramatically changed. But sadly, what we have seen is that sexual exploitation and abuse is endemic across the international aid sector. And similar patterns have been repeated again and again over the years. A wide range of organisations who were meant to be helping the most vulnerable have abused them instead. And although brave victims and whistleblowers have spoken out, too often it is them, rather than the perpetrators, who end up being penalised. While much lip service has been paid to ending sexual abuse and exploitation across the aid sector, there has been much less courageous and practical action, I sadly believe there will be much more such cases in the future. The very least that we can do is look squarely in the face of these abuses and continue to demand accountability and change. Thank you for listening to Justice Studio Sessions. We have so enjoyed deep diving into social justice with you. Justice Studio provides compassionate consultancy rooted in social justice. If you would like to work with us, please visit our website at www.justicestudio.org or email us at info@justicestudio.org. This podcast relies on your support. If you love our content and would like to see this podcast reach more people, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating or leave us a lovely review. We would be delighted for you to share your thoughts, musings, or favourite parts of the podcast with us on social media. You can tag and or follow Marianne at creatrix.london and Justice Studio at Justice Studio on all the major social sites. This podcast was hosted by Marianne Moore and produced by Justice Studio Limited. The music was by Luke Fraser at The Tonic, and the artwork was by Marianne. Thank you so much for listening.